One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, the first month is only 99 cents. And there are multiple plans to choose from, including a 3-month plan and an annual plan. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. Gaia.com. Gaia.com.
Hello, everybody, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. That's right, it's me, Cam. And as always, over here pounding coffee today, mi amigo, Mr. Filio Kyle Filson. Philly, what you drinking? What kind of coffee you got in there?
You know, I'd be lying if I said I knew. I do not know. My wife brings
You just grabbed
home.
Some beans, didn't
it
you?
It comes home in a white bag, and it's just beans in there. And then I grind them up and brew it up. I don't really know. If I was to tell you which ones are my favorite in real life.
It is the bag you got 3 weeks from last week.
I like Sumatran. Mm-hmm. Coffee, and I like coffee beans from Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
I seem to like those flavors the best. I'm not real big on fancy flavors like hazelnut.
No,
I'm not hating. It's just, to me, I like traditional coffee, and yeah. I prefer to grind my own. I think it has a little bit stronger of a flavor.
Well, I'm with you. I don't like all the wild flavors. I don't know what it is about it. It's almost like it's too much. You know, it's like all the flavorful liqueurs. Like, if I want to drink liquor, I just want liquor-flavored liquor.
It carries over to more than just coffee. I'm the same way with almost everything in life. Yeah. Like, when we go to, get ice cream with the kids, they get all these crazy stuff. I usually get, vanilla, or I'll get chocolate.
That's me. I'm a chocolate.
What's wrong with the normal? I don't need, some crazy name. My wife's the opposite. They come out with some drink, it'll have, 20 names long. Of some type of coffee from Starbucks,
my daughter.
New type of ice cream. I'll take a sip. I'm like, well, it's good. I'm okay. There's nothing wrong with chocolate.
No, there's nothing.
Right?
What's wrong with vanilla? What's wrong with chocolate?
I do like pistachio ice cream. I have to say that's pretty good.
You know what? If I don't want
to. I only do that maybe once every 3 years. I'll go a little. I'm going to gut my hair out. I'm going to go a little crazy. I'm going to get pistachio ice cream.
If you let your hair out, it's like an eighth of an inch.
I wish I could let my hair out.
I wish you could too.
You were asking me about that yesterday at the tournament. One of the kids was like, why do you cut your hair like that? I'm like, what? Well, you know, it's real short on top. I go, we don't grow. I'm just trying to look cool.
I'm just trying to be get my reverse mohawk going. None in the top, all on the sides, baby, all on the sides. Brud, we had a blast doing this interview.
Yeah.
This was so much fun. No news today, folks. We get in it. We go for a while. We got to talk to a friend of ours, somebody that we've admired just from their work, and it's kind of inspired us to do stuff, and that's kind of what sent us down the path of videos and things that we're going on. Yeah. Fill them in real quick.
Well, it's pretty cool. We talk about cryptids all the time on the show, and everybody seems to really like that. And one of the most popular, of course, is Bigfoot or Sasquatch.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what we're going to be talking about today. The guy we're having on the show today, he's a really cool guy. I've admired him for a while. I've admired his work, but I never got to speak with him actually until this interview. And he's a documentary filmmaker. Now, he doesn't do just films on cryptids, so don't get that idea. He's a filmmaker and a really good one.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done 2 already, and he's coming out with a new one that comes out November 11th, I mm-hmm. believe, and it's awesome. Now, his first movie he did was called Minerva Monster, and it was really cool. And then the other one he did was The Beast of Whitehall. Excellent. and then this very new one he's coming out. And the reason I found out about this newest one was because our friend Lyle Blackburn is like the main star of the show, pretty much. Boggy Creek Monster. It's excellent. If you'd like to watch documentary films and you're into cryptozoology and cryptids, I suggest you go watch all three of these. And they get better with time. Seth is getting better with his filmmaking, the cameras and equipment or whatever. I don't know what he's doing, but he's getting better at it. This new one is amazing. But the other two are awesome, too.
That's true.
Just you get to see not just the interesting stories, but the eyewitnesses to these stories. And I'm talking about police officers, everything. This is it's very, very interesting. Small Town Monsters. That's the website. I'll put links to it, of course, in the show notes. You can go on Vimeo. You can rent these. I think they're like $2.99 to rent them. Or you can buy them digital downloads. Or you can buy an actual DVD if you like to have the DVD at your house. Excellent interview. Seth Breedlove is the guy we're talking to. He's from Ohio. An amazing filmmaker. And I can't wait to get into it. It's pretty cool. What do you have?
Well, another thing, too, that I love about it is because he's like us. He's constantly busy. He does the podcast Sass What? Is what I guess he keeps in between of doing all these films. Freelance work, writing, all this stuff. So I admire a guy that embraces the grind. Anybody that just embraces the grind and says, this is what I'm going to do and whatever it entails, I'm going to just chase it. And he does a great job at it, man. I mean, the whole thing. And you can really tell that he enjoys. He's not just going through the motions. And I think you'll pick up on that whenever we talk to him. You'll pick up on that when you see his work. So that's what I appreciate.
Yeah, well, let's get into the interview.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
All righty, folks. We are back and ready to rock with our amigo here, the filmmaker extraordinaire himself, Mr. Seth Breedlove. Seth, my friend, how are you doing?
I'm awesome. Thanks for having me on tonight.
Man, oh man. Look, dude, we really appreciate all the work you've put in with all of the Small Town Monster stuff. I love it. I can't. I'm drawn into videos anyway. Of course, everybody loves podcasts. Heck, we're doing. Everybody loves to listen. You do a podcast. Was it Sass What? We all enjoy that. But there's something about the visual filmmaking that just it reminds me of a child going into the movies and seeing these things. And I really appreciate, I guess, more than anything. So let me start this whole thing off. With how you tell the stories, and by how, what I mean by that is there's no angle. A lot of people will take an angle when they tell a story, and they want it to, like you're trying to tell it from the point of you want this to be real. You're imposing the idea of this to be real, or you're going in there imposing the idea of it not. And I like how in your movies you tell the stories of here's the facts. This is what we've got. These are the sightings. This is what we see. We give the history. We give the look. And the cinematography is beautiful, and we let it go, and we leave it up to you. And that's what I enjoy the most about what you do and how you present it. So with that being said, when did the bug, what age did the filmmaking bug bite you?
So I was raised by parents who owned a bookstore, and we spent a ton of time on the road doing book shows, historical book shows, Civil War book shows, all these different historical, you know, type of shows. So we're gone almost every weekend, which meant that I spent a ton of time in hotel rooms waiting on my parents to come back, you know, after running this table, which meant I watched a ton of movies. But my mom, I think, is responsible for a lot of this stuff because she got me into Ray Harryhausen movies and Hammer horror films when I was young, like 12 years old. And you know, a lot of kids when I was a kid made fun of me for watching like old black and white movies. But I honestly think my love of filmmaking stems from the fact that my mom got me into the kind of classic film when I was a kid. I mean, I remember watching Casablanca and Maltese Falcon and The Big Sleep when I was like 12 and 13 years old and thinking they were amazing. And I grew to love like David Lean movies when I was a kid and all this stuff. So I think it was when I was like 12, 13, and then it just grew during my teens. It was absurd. I basically gave up any kind of social life to sit in my room and just watch movies and read books about filmmaking and Billy Wilder and all that kind of stuff. And I was going to be a director. I mean, there was no doubt in my mind when I was 17, 18 years old, that was what I was going to do after school, was I was going to direct films. And then I should come back to this at some point, but one of my good friends, one of the probably the first friend I made who was into filmmaking, actually was the cinematographer on Boggy Creek Monster. And we met when I was 18 because we were both super into filmmaking. And I was like grabbing this New York Film Academy flyer from a bookstore, and he happened to see me holding it. And he was like, "Hey man, you like movie making?" I was like, "Yeah." And like, anyway, I after probably around the time I was like 20, 21, I hadn't gone to film school and I hadn't done any movies other than these shorts I was making with friends. And at some point I just went out and got a regular job and I was like, forget it. I'm done. I'm not doing this ever again. And I just thought that that wasn't realistic. Like making movies wasn't realistic. And so, you know, years pass. I at some point started writing freelance for local newspapers. And when we, you know, one thing's led to the next, and I've told this story like 100 times. So that story where like I created the book proposal for what became Small Town Monsters, mm-hmm. and it became a movie. Well, like it never struck me until after Minerva was done and was released that I had just made a movie, like a movie. Like I had created a movie. And, so that was the long way of saying that I've been into film forever, and this was my dream actually to make movies when I was younger. But for some reason, it never really registered until about, you know, a year ago that I was actually making movies. It wasn't what I had pictured myself making, you know, when I was a kid, but I'm making movies. So, and we could talk for hours about that stuff because I freaking love filmmaking, and I think anyone can make movies. This is what I always say, and people think I'm being self-deprecating. It's not that at all. I really think anyone could go out and learn how to make movies now because of how affordable technology has become and how we have all this amazing computer software and all that kind of stuff. I think anyone can create film, and so I always try to encourage people to do that, because if you look at a movie and you think that's impossible for me to do, you're just not aware of how accessible this stuff has become. I think anyone can do it. It just takes a certain almost idiocy to just jump in and do it.
So we can, from the start, we can blame your mother, because she sounds like a wonderful woman. That sounds, yes, like perfect. She's pointed you in the right direction, and I couldn't agree more. Anybody can go out and do it. And what I think I appreciate the most about the ease of getting into these things is more and more people now, you get to see more and more other person's perspective on things, whereas before it was limited to those that had the knowledge or those that had the money. And now it seems to be kind of evened out to where more and more people are involved and we get to see those things. Because I know a lot of people have asked, and they ask in a lot of your interviews, oh, what made you get into this? You know, what made you get into the crypto and things like that? But that's not all that you're into. You know, it's much like a lot of people don't realize that Lauren Coleman is really into documentaries. He's a documentary instructor, as far as I know, a professor of documentary, mm-hmm. film. So they don't realize that he's made films outside of the crypto realm.
Right.
Several of them. So it's just because you do this doesn't mean that this is how you're typecast or this is the corner that's cast you in. This is just a story that you enjoy telling and you found other stories to tell. So we want to make sure people realize that this isn't just all that you do. You're not just a crypto guy. You're a filmmaker. That's what you do. That being said, right, let's start off with the fact you're from Ohio, mm-hmm. and that's where your first movie, the one you were speaking of, that's kind of where this whole thing kicked off, in Minerva. Now, we've done an episode about the Minerva Monster, but the way you did it, it's one of those things. It is a terrifying little story to start with, first and foremost, for the people that can you give them a breakdown for the people that don't know what the Minerva, yeah, Monster is, the rundown of it?
Yeah, so in 1978, this family... 78, is that right? Yes. I get so confused because every single movie we made is based in the 70s.
Yeah.
78, the Caton family lived outside of Minerva, Ohio, right off the Lincoln Highway. They started seeing this unusual creature on the hill behind their house. It would throw rocks at their house. It was always watching them. It was like a very unusual kind of situation. They didn't know what the creature was. It wasn't a bear. It wasn't a mountain lion or anything like that, although it did seem to have black panthers with it whenever they saw it. But in that summer, during the month of August, they found their dog ripped out of its leash with its neck snapped. And the following evening, the creature appeared again on the hill behind their house and came up closer. So the family retreated into the house. The mother actually pulled a gun on the creature because the creature came right up to the window. The family had retreated into the kitchen, and it was actually standing there looking in the window at them. So they called the police. The police came out to investigate, and by then the creature had disappeared. And the story became this massive... kind of, at least regionally, it became a huge story because the Akron Beacon Journal sent a reporter out and she covered the story, and the story went viral. It hit the AP Newswire, and then you had other newspapers from around the world showing up on the Caton's property trying to find this, you know, this amazing story and all this kind of stuff. And then, of course, what happens with all these cases is the drunken kind of Bigfoot hillbilly hunters show up in their trucks with guns and beer, and they start wandering around the Caton's home trying to kill a monster. And meanwhile, the Caton's are just suffering, you know, ridiculed nonstop, pretty much, especially the kids that were in school at the time. They're just being kind of ridiculed mercilessly by townspeople. That's the basic gist of what the Minerva Monster story is. If you watch our movie, that's kind of what you hear about. And then you hear about some of the ancillary cases and you learn a little bit about the fact that the Catons had been seeing this creature before 1978 and they still see it up till today. But there's a lot of side stories and little rabbit trails you can go down with that story that I absolutely love, that I hope to someday be able to tell some of that, you know, the ancillary stuff to that story, because there's a lot there. But it's a really, really fascinating case, and it's kind of a microcosm for the whole Ohio Bigfoot phenomenon, I think, because it's just unusual. A lot of people don't connect Bigfoot with Ohio, even though now it's considered like, you know, one of the Bigfoot capitals of the world or whatever. I mean, Salt Fork State Park is like Bigfoot Mecca. But it's just a really unusual case when you factor in things like the Black Panther sightings and some of those really almost paranormal aspects to the story. It's not quite as straightforward as it comes across in our movie.
I was hoping you'll do one like Revisited, where you'll go back and touch up on some of those wild stories. Let me ask you this, though. Did you have, before you went in and sat down and talked to these people and did your thing, did you have a preconceived notion that changed after you got there?
About them or about the case?
About, any of it, but I would probably say more about them, because it's one of those things. The case is one thing, but lots of times with people, you don't really know the sincerity of a human being until you're sitting there talking to them. And you can always kind of sniff it out after you've interviewed enough people. You're like, yeah, this is cool story, bro, but I don't think I'm buying it.
Yeah. With the Caton family, I had spoken to them a couple times on the phone, and I had actually gotten a really great version of the story from Howie's sister, who is not in the film. She turned us down, but her take on the Minerva Monster case is very different from Howie's. And it's a lot more personal. And her kind of connecting the creature appearing and disappearing with her mother, who eventually died. She actually told me that when her mother died, she believes that the creature went away, whereas the rest of the family is convinced it's still there. So, but I think what amazed me and still amazes me is that the more bizarre aspects of the story that come out from members of the family, the more other members of this family back up that story. So the prime example would be this. In the movie, there's a story that Howie tells about being on the hill behind their house with a neighbor lady, And they're standing there, and she's this neighbor lady's kind of mocking this entire idea of there being a creature behind their house. And she says, she yells up into the woods. She says, if you're up there right now, why don't you throw a rock and hit me, you know, right between the eyes with a rock or something like that. And because this creature was supposedly always throwing rocks. So she says this, and at that moment, keep in mind, this is late in the evening. There's nobody up there that they know of. As soon as she says this, something throws a rock out of the woods and cracks her right between the eyes with this rock.
And, talk about your all-time backfires.
Right. And Howie tells that story like it's him telling me he picked up, you know, McDonald's for dinner last night. Like there's nothing, like no big deal. This is what happened. And I'm thinking, until this past summer, that for some reason, I don't know why, this is just the way my brain works. For some reason, I'll let a story about a giant hairy monster living in the woods behind a house go. But a story about a lady getting hit between the eyes with a rock is where I'm like crying foul. But, I had thought that story sounded far-fetched. Mm-hmm. And then this past summer, I came to find out, talking to Howie's wife, that she was there and saw it happen. And then the craziest thing was at Minerva Monster Day, Lauren Coleman had a lady come up to his table and introduce herself and her mother. And her mother was the daughter of the lady that got hit between the eyes with a rock. Wow. And so and the other lady was there to see it happen. So like I've had that story corroborated now by like three different people, and that was the one that sounded so kind of far-fetched to me.
The red flag. And then that's like, whoops, my bad.
Yeah. So and there's other things, you know, like last year, Brandon, my producer, he actually went down and went on a hike with the Catons about 3 miles up into the woods behind their house. And the forest behind their house, I always say you could walk in that forest and probably walk all the way to Pennsylvania and only cross a couple roads. Because it's forest all the way, you know, to PA, which is probably an hour away. And, but he went on this walk with them, and Howie told this story about one night they were up in the woods, and the family knew never to go into the woods after dark, because that's their time is what he called it. That's the creature's time. And you don't go in the woods. They'll warn you out of the woods. They'll chase you out of the woods, all this stuff. So he's in there too late one night, and they start hearing all this weird, you know, howling and stuff. And they're walking along, and suddenly something swings down from a tree, picks Howie up, you know, like it's swinging on a vine or something like Tarzan, picks him up and launches him like 6 feet. And he lands on the ground. And as he's telling Brandon the story, three or four of the other people that were in their group with them were nodding their heads saying they saw this happen.
Mm. Oh my God.
So, I mean, it's like the more unusual the case becomes, the more people there are to back up those, you know, bizarre aspects to the story. It's a really, but I guess what I'm saying is this family has no reason to make all this up. They really don't care if you believe them. They really don't. They have photos of things in the woods. I haven't seen the photos. Brandon saw the photos. They have photos of things that they've, you know, taken that they claim is the creature. But they're not going to share them with anyone. They're really, you know, the most common question we get asked is, well, why don't they put out game cams? Why don't they try to take, they don't care. Like they know it's there. They're not interested in proving it's there. They're not interested if whether or not you believe them. It took me 3 months to convince Howie to be in our film. He'd never been on camera before in anything. So they have no reason to lie about it. So I guess my, you know, my opinion changed or didn't change, but I guess my belief in the fact that they honestly do believe everything they're saying was strengthened by actually talking to the family.
Yeah, man. And I agree with you. When it comes to people that don't seem to be interested in getting on a TV, especially, or a movie or something, it does make you wonder. To me, it just, for whatever reason, it seems like it's more real because you're like, look, this person isn't seeking fame or fortune, where you see these people at these conventions, I'm sure you've been to them before, where they're peddling this stuff and they're doing anything and everything they can. They don't care what TV show it is. They just want to get on TV. They want to share their story, or they have multiple encounters. Like I've seen the thing 37 times. I can take you out there tomorrow and show it to you. that always raises a red flag for me. I'm like, you're talking about something that, if real, has only been seen by a handful of people, and then you can just, you have a habitual site there where you're feeding it, you have a gift tree, and you're leaving candy bars for it and stuff. I don't know. I'm not saying they're lying. I just have a harder time believing people like that. But you're right. And Minerva Monster isn't your only film. After that, you did The Beast of Whitehall. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, Beast of Whitehall, we had kind of settled on Whitehall being our next film as far back as May of 2014. I'm losing track of the years. No, 2015. So actually, when Minerva Monster was coming out, we had officially decided we were making Beast of Whitehall as our next film the same day that Minerva was supposed to premiere. And the crazily enough, that as I'm telling the guys that this is our next movie, we found out that the main witness, the absolute, you know, your biggest witness, one of the teenagers that was in this truck, had actually passed away. So it was one of these crazy stories, and in the end, that actually became a part of our movie, the fact that people are passing away and we're losing so much of this history. But the case actually is called the Hebert Incident, which is basically this week-long series of events that occurred on Hebert Road outside of Whitehall, New York, which is at the base of the Adirondack Mountains, kind of in eastern New York on the border with Vermont. Hebert Road's maybe like a mile down the street from the Vermont border. And I know that because we got lost almost every single time we drove to Hebert Road and ended up driving into Vermont, laughing hysterically about how we were back in Vermont. The case basically revolved around these three kids that were driving this back road one night, saw a creature in a field, drove back into town, got the police came out. And when I say police, I mean eight different members of law enforcement from three different agencies, state police, city police, and state troopers. And they all witnessed the creature in this field. So 11 people in this field that night, possibly more, because there were cars parked on both sides too, you know, like people who were just trying to drive through when all this was going on. So other people might have seen it as well. But basically after that incident occurred, it kind of spurred all these other sightings that took place around the area during that week. You know, there was a guy that lived on a back road who claimed he had fired shots at a creature. There were other law enforcement officers saw it. Brian Gosselin, who was the brother of Paul Gosselin, who was one of the teenagers in the truck that initially had the encounter, had his own encounter the following evening in the same field, kind of off Hebert. And, I don't know what drew me to this story. It's funny, 'cause you know, like the Minerva story is very personal. The movie, I think, almost feels like a haunted house story or something, because it's all kind of occurring in this one house and in this one location. And Hebert is a little bit bigger. Beast of Whitehall is a little bit bigger because it's more about the Adirondacks in general. And so I'm not really sure what it was about this story that really drew me in. But I think once we got out there to Whitehall, the fact that we were losing witnesses is what kind of spurred me on to continue going in that, you know, actually making the movie. Mm-hmm. Because when we lost Paul Gosselin, I was like, well, maybe we shouldn't even do this because we just lost, you know, the main witness. How are we going to make this movie at all? Some things happened during the making of that movie too. Like that movie was originally supposed to be basically a 5 to 10 minute short film that we were going to use as a Kickstarter reward for people who backed Boggy Creek Monster. not to be too convoluted, but like that was the plan. You know, we were going to make this short film. If you back Boggy Creek Monster, you get access to the short film as one of the rewards. And maybe someday, you know, we'll include it on the Boggy Creek DVD or something. But we actually went last July and filmed a lot of our B-roll and interviews and all sorts of stuff. And then there was a falling out between myself and the producer team. And I actually ended up going back last September and refilming all the interviews. So technically I shot that movie twice. But what happened during the making of it was I just found that there was we could have made a 90-minute movie about the Whitehall, you know, creature and the Adirondack incident, because we barely scratched the surface of that case. But unfortunately, it's like one of those things where you're limited by money and time because, you know, I do have a kind of a regular job in addition to making movies. So it's like, and that was not a film that we were ever going to do a Kickstarter for, because originally it was actually going to be used as part of a Kickstarter. So our budget on that was non-existent. So but what we ended up with was a 39-minute short film that gives a really concise look at the Hebert incident as it occurred over the course of that week, back in 1976. And it's my baby. Like, I love Boggy Creek. I think Boggy Creek's probably our best movie of the three by far. You know, you can see so much growth in so many different areas technically, you know, from a filmmaking standpoint and all kinds of things. But I had such a amazing experience making Beast of Whitehall because it was so small scale. I mean, it was basically myself and my friend Brandon and my dad filming it. And then when it got to editing, it was just Brandon and I.
Wow. So that's a lot of work for two people, you know?
Yeah. No, it's, and I think because of that, I'll always feel extremely attached to that movie. And I'll have these amazing memories of sitting here on my crappy all-in-one computer attempting to edit that movie in Premiere Elements while the entire computer was, you know, crashing over and over again because I could barely keep up with the amount of memory I was using. And I just, it was an amazing experience making that movie. And I love, the other thing is I love that area. I love the Adirondacks and I love Whitehall and just the experience of making it. And I loved Paul Bartholomew, who was in the film. I had a blast with that guy. So yeah, that's my, well, I always refer to that. I tell people that's my baby. And when people ask me what my favorite movie is of the three, I always say Whitehall, although Boggy hasn't even officially been released yet. So who knows? Maybe it'll change over time.
Well, and that's the perfect, it's funny because you said, well, I didn't even realize I was going to be a filmmaker again until I made your first one. And then now you're like, oh, now I've got drawn into my favorite one. And then it wasn't even going to be a film. It was just going to be an extra that you threw in there with it. So Minerva Monster drew you into it. the Beast of Whitehall, yeah. You ended up making your favorite. And now we got to discuss what we got you here for.
The brand new one.
The brand new one. The one that, this movie, I love it. And the reason that me and Kyle, of course, we love it is it's close to us. We're not really that far away, a few hours away from Falk. We know Lyle. We've watched your other, you see all this. It was the perfect culmination. And the cinematography in this movie is something that I truly enjoy.
Oh, it's,
you've
it's,
outdone yourself, sir.
Yeah, it's amazing. And not to pick on you, I'm not going to say that. But if you do watch all three of your films, you can definitely see a transition where it's much, as you're doing yes. more, they're getting better.
Yeah.
I think Boggy Creek, not that the other ones look bad by any means, but the Boggy Creek, the photography is amazing. I don't even know if you filmed it with a higher end camera or something, but it's the clarity. I don't know if it's 8K. I don't know what it is, but it looks on point. I mean, you can see some of the drone footage, some of the photos there in the swamp, almost water level, you feel like. The walking through the woods, and especially the shots where it's like Lyle walking with one of the people he's interviewing. It visually, it's an amazing documentary.
Very appealing.
And then when you get into the subject matter, it's just more. Anybody that listens to our show who's into these topics, if you like documentaries, if you like these cheesy shows that are on the History Channel, Animal Planet, things like that, you need to check out Seth's movies because these are amazing. Can you tell us what made you decide on choosing Boggy Creek? Because Minerva, I mean, you know, like you said, you learned about it as a child. It's there in your home state. But Boggy, of all the other sightings across the nation, what made you choose that one?
Well, actually, it was Lyle.
okay.
He's very persuasive.
Back in 2000, and Lyle and I have tried to peg down the time, and it was whenever we had Lyle on Sasquatch. And okay. When he was on Sasquatch, but even that is okay. I know what it is. So at the Ohio Bigfoot Conference back in 2014, I met Lyle for the first time, and he was, you know, I filmmaking, I don't think was even a factor in my mind at that point, other than dreaming about maybe making Small Town Monsters as a movie. I bumped into Lyle and bought Beast of Waugi Creek, and mm-hmm. or maybe I'd already read it at that point. But either way, we were talking, and I told him, okay, I definitely read it, because I told him about my book proposal for Small Town Monsters, because that proposal was done in 2013, and this would have been 2014. So I said to Lyle, you know, like, I'm working on this proposal. It's about, you know, small towns and not just the creature sightings, but like how it influences the culture of the small town and changes it and how it affects the people. And he was like, man, that sounds awesome. He's like, you know, I'd love to see some of your work, like your written work, and maybe we could collaborate on something someday. And I was like, all right, cool. And then about a year passed, and I started Sasquatch, and we had Lyle on, and this was when Minerva was happening. So Minerva was going to be coming out in a year, you know, or something like that, like 8 months. And Lyle was like, hey, when you're done with Minerva, if you're interested in making a documentary about the Boggy Creek story, you know, I'd love to, you know, do that with you. So I was like, okay, cool. And then, you know, a couple of months passed, and Minerva was coming out. And at that point, I made the decision that after Minerva, we were going to make Boggy. And then I came up with the idea of throwing Whitehall in between making Minerva and making Boggy. So it all came back to Lyle. Like, Lyle wanted to do this story, and he was one of the big proponents for Minerva Monster originally. He really talked it up. He wrote a little blurb about it in Rue Morgue. So a lot of our success early on actually is owed to Lyle. So, and then, you know, like, it was intense, because after Minerva, we did go, there was a split, you know, a creative split. And I was like, well, and this was before Whitehall's come out. So I'm like, well, I hope that he isn't going to be concerned about, you know, well, maybe the creative split is going to affect the quality of the movie. So I was extremely relieved when Whitehall came out, and you watched Whitehall and loved that equally. So, but yeah, everything comes back to Lyle, and the fact that, I mean, I hadn't even watched Legend of Boggy Creek until 2015.
How dare you, sir?
I know. I know. I had no, and like, my emotional attachment to Legend of Boggy Creek hasn't even really happened until the last half year, you know, maybe year. Well, it's definitely, I keep forgetting like how long it's been since we filmed this movie. So it's probably, there was a period of time last winter when we were started working on it where I was literally falling asleep, like listening to it just to try to get myself, you know, thinking in that direction and get ideas for the movie. But a lot of my attachment to the Legend of Boggy Creek now is owed to Lyle and that book. I mean, I read his book long before I saw the movie, The Legend of Boggy Creek.
And then, of course, bad luck, like with Paul, strikes again, and we lose Smokey.
Yeah. And that happened, what, like last, February, March, something like that. It was right before we were going to film.
Mm-hmm.
So we did, just like with Beast of Whitehall, where we were able to get those audio taped interviews with the original witnesses from Bill Brand, which was a huge get for us on that movie. We were actually able to give a voice to people who'd passed away. With this movie, we were able to use some taped interviews with Smokey too. So we were able to kind of introduce Smokey to an audience, you know, through his voice. But yeah, that was a crushing blow to me, especially because, like, Smokey's become one of my, just to tell you about the story. So the Boggy Creek story is massive, right? I mean, it's this sprawling history of this region of Arkansas. And when I was coming at the story and trying to figure out how we were going to make a movie out of this, I had no emotional end. I couldn't find a single point of reference for myself to really get emotionally invested. And if you've watched the movie, which you guys have, mm-hmm. there is a very personal kind of emotional kick, especially to the end of the film. And I do pride myself on the fact that I think we give heart to some of these stories that, where, you know, typically Bigfoot movies are, especially docs, are more about like either scaring you or introducing you to like unbeatable scientific evidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm more interested in heart and people and the human side of the story.
The story, the human experience of what the people in that town went through. I loved it.
So like when I'm trying to come up with that, I could not find my way into the story. And there were a few things that eventually came around. One of them is the Searcy house, which if you've seen the movie should be obvious because it's the culmination of the whole, you know, movie. The whole story kind of culminates at that location. It's this dilapidated, crumbling home. And for some reason that broke my heart. I have no idea why. There's a shot. I don't even think it's in the film. We shot their mailbox, which was actually, we found crushed on the other side of the road. It was like someone had driven over it, and it said, the mother's name, I can't remember her name, and it said something, whatever her name was, and then Searcy. And for some reason that just hit me, you know, like I thought about my parents' home and like, what would it be like if that house was crushed like this house was, and this mailbox is just laying on the, anyway, I'm going all over the map here, but like, That was one of the emotional anchors for me. And then the other one is Smokey. And his I refer to it as he's like Ahab in Moby Dick, and Bigfoot was his white whale.
Yeah.
and that was one of the emotional ins for me was Smokey. So when he passed away, I was really disappointed, especially because I didn't actually get to meet him last October, even though I was standing 15, 20 feet away from him for 2 hours. I just could not bring myself to go bug him. There were so many people surrounding him the whole time, and he was up there in years, and you could just tell he wasn't doing very good. And I just felt weird about going over and being like, hey, you know, I'm making a movie about you. So I couldn't do it. And now I kick myself because I wish I could have at least shook his hand. But yeah, he passed away right when we were getting ready to film this.
And then with you, I almost wish you hadn't have said that about the Captain Ahab thing, because now it makes an attachment for me that I didn't even know was there. I'm like, oh, man, he's right.
It's a great analogy.
I'm just bummed. Smooth. I think the thing that gets me the most about this one as far as being my favorite, and what a lot of people, the people that are listening to this, those that haven't seen the movie that will, and those that haven't read the book or haven't looked into this, is what you said is sprawling is the perfect term for it, because it's not a small localized thing. This has been seen, this creature, this thing has been seen by multiple people in this area, multiple times, multiple families, and throughout a long period of time, so much so that even the old retired sheriff, he treats it like it's just like, well, we saw wild dogs today. I mean, to them, it's a normal thing. And that's the funniest thing to me about this whole deal is the normalcy that they place, if that's even a word, that they place on this whole thing.
The sheriff told us, and this stat should have been in the movie. Somehow it wasn't. So if I do a director's cut, it will be. He told us or maybe it is in the movie. I can't think. Anyway, he told us that he took calls every 3 weeks for 60 some years.
I think he may say that in the movie now that you, I think he may say that while he's sending in there.
Okay.
I think it may be in there.
Maybe it's insane. The trailer.
And if you think about how many reports that is over that long of a period of time, I mean, that is a crazy figure. But you know, I mean, Lyle last fall when I was there, I asked him how many personal reports he had taken. It was 78. It was like 70, 78, 88, something like that. And that's just people that have reported their sighting to him, not the historical sightings, it does seem like I've never been to a place where so many people seem to have seen the creature. Like I walked into the Monster Mart on my first day there and a guy standing at the counter wants to tell me about how his brother saw something right down the street from the Monster Mart like 2 weeks before.
Right. I don't think people, and we say this all the time on the show, unless you've been to East Texas and that part into Arkansas and seen all, you really can't appreciate what we say when we say heavily wooded. Now you were down there in the swamps and all, so but people don't understand. I'm like, when we talk about this, it's not like what people get the idea of till you go there. I'm like, you can understand that there are areas that unless you have a four-wheel drive vehicle or you're willing to hike, you're not getting into.
It's jungle-like. We used the term in the movie. I wrote that term for Lyle's narration, jungle-like. And I don't know if you noticed, but like the color palette, especially at the beginning of the movie, the pre-title sequence where Lyle's narrating about the mm-hmm. kind of a Rod Serling type of narration about the, you know, the abomination that lives in the swamps. And then you go into the title sequence, which is basically a lot of different shots of the forest and all that kind of stuff. Anytime we showed the swamp, the river bottoms, any of that stuff in the movie, I with the color palette, I actually tried to make it look like another planet or something. I mean, those, especially that opening title sequence, though. I mean, it because it feels that way. So I was attempting to actually, with the color, like kind of make it seem like this otherworldly kind of place, because it really feels like you are not. I mean, unless you're from that area, I'm sure if you're from that area, it's probably it's just common. But for me, from Ohio, that was as foreign to me as if you had airdropped me onto like friggin' Mars. Like I had no clue what was standing 20 feet away from me in the undergrowth. You know, there could have been anything in there. So yeah, it's unbelievably intimidating to be in that area, especially the Sulphur River bottoms and the mm-hmm. Mercer Bayou. Mercer Bayou is probably the kind of creepiest place I went to. It's got these old abandoned oil wells, and then you've got the, you know, the water's black, and there's alligators, and it's like being on Mars.
Yeah, we call them tank batteries. A lot of people look like water storage tanks, the old empty tanks sitting rusting and just sitting. And you're talking about at the end of old oil and gas roads, and there's just everything's grown up.
And it's in the background too in one of our interviews.
Yes,
I just thought it looked so cool to have that behind John.
Well, it does look otherworldly the way you've put that, and I think you did a great job of putting that forward, because that's another reason I want people to see this film, is because those that have never seen it, never witnessed it on the screen or in person, it'll give you an idea of what this place looks like. There is several clips and several setups of the filming that you do that's down on the bayou, down on the swamps. It's got Lyle and somebody that he's interviewing, and they're walking, and you can get a sense of, if you go 20 yards off where they're walking, you couldn't see them. They're going to move off into the, and that's it. So you got to imagine something 100 yards from you, you wouldn't see it. And you're going to live in the roughest part of these swamps. So whatever mm-hmm. this thing is, it's not like somebody running around having a good time. You want to run around out there in the dark, that's on you. Good luck with that, because you're not going to put a suit on and truck around out there with snakes and the mosquitoes and everything else that's running around out there. So you see all that. It really truly is like another planet. And then also, so's the town, because people that don't come from small towns don't realize that. Like our town here used to be that small. We're in a town of over 25,000 people now.
We always joke like it's going back in time when you go to those towns.
When you go to those towns, you go back in time 34. You're talking about going back to where when you walk into some of these little convenience stores, little mom and pops, people quit talking. You're a new mm-hmm. guy. They don't know what you're doing there. Everybody's chit-chatting until you walk in, and then it's all eyes on you. So when you get into that circle, they're not going to tell people outside of that circle any lies. Why would they make this stuff up? And like mm-hmm. you bring up the Monster Mart, and we get emails and messages about this before, and we've talked about it, is, well, obviously they're making money off of it. Yeah, they are obviously making money off of it, but you also have to think of the amount of money they're making off of it. We're not talking this guy's bringing in, you know, $500,000-$600,000 a year from the Monster Mart. You know, we're not talking about raking in money. We're talking about the guys just like that want to talk to you when you show up down there. They're willing to talk about it because to them, it's like if I came to your house, Seth, right now, and you were to tell me about one of your dogs. That's it. That's the way they talk about this thing, because to them, they're brought up in it. And that is a unique part of Americana. I'm glad you captured it, because that's something these films of yours capture. And that's what I think needs to be seen, is people like, it's one thing, like we said, you can always spot a liar most of the time, 70-80% of the time. But it's these little niches like this, these little spots in our country, to where these I guess, sightings or any of these encounters really took place, that people, they scoff at it until you really get to see, like you were talking about, that trying to find a connection. And I've always had a connection to it because of the original movie of The Legend of Boggy Creek, yeah, and all this, and the monster, and then the whole Smokey, listening to Smokey do interviews online, you know, that you can go back and listen to. That was up, but the way you explained it, the whole thing, I'm really, really glad you did it the way you did it, and I think you did an amazing job of it.
Awesome. Yeah, this is cool, because like, you guys are the first ones that I've gotten to actually verbally, like audibly talk to about the film, who've seen it, who I don't have, who didn't actually help me make the movie or aren't like my parents.
So that's
cool for me.
Well, we've read the books. We're kind of, well, you know, I wouldn't say we're the best, but we're very well versed in a lot of the stuff that went on there. So to, mm-hmm, see the way you told the story and then to let the people just tell their story, that's the best thing, is just let them come off with the way they are, because you can spot it genuine. They're just like, they're telling you a story, like I said, like they'd be talking about their wife's pies or cupcakes or something. Like, this is just what we do. This happens here every time.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Seth, was it hard to find witnesses willing to come forward and be on camera and tell their story, or were they people that Lyle had known when he was doing research for his book? Because I know he's spoken to me several times. That's funny. He told me when he was working with you, he didn't tell me that he was like narrating the show and doing the whole, I'm like, wow, I thought you had like a small cameo in it, Lyle. You basically were the whole, you know, the narrator and everything.
This is, so we should talk about that actually in a minute. But yeah, as far as getting witnesses in the film for our other movies, it was not a nightmare, because I actually really enjoy that challenge, but it was an ongoing situation where I'm trying to get people in Minerva and Whitehall. With this one, Lyle just got it.
Pulled out his Rolodex.
He had all these people already and brought them to us. Lyle on this film is very much a partner. You know, we gave him a co-producer credit, but I mean, he probably did more from a production standpoint on the movie as far as actually producing the movie than I did. He's been extremely involved with the movie. And just to go back to what you were saying about Lyle narrating and being in the film, I mean, just to speak very frankly about it, it was extremely intimidating to me to have Lyle involved, not because I'm intimidated by Lyle, but because of the fact that our movies prior to this prided themselves on the fact that, if nothing else, prided themselves on the fact that it was just the witnesses' stories. You know, you're just hearing about the towns and the witnesses, and that's it. And when Lyle wanted to be involved, Lyle never came to me and was like, listen, I want to star in this thing. I want to be on camera. I want to be narrating it. It was kind of the opposite. It was more like, you know, whatever you need, if you want to put me in it, I'll be in it. You know, do a talking head interview. I think he was expecting me to shoot like a little sit down interview with him, you know, for like 15, 20 minutes. And then he gets to go home and we make the movie. But I told him very early on, I was like, if you're going to be involved in the movie, I can't do that. I can't just shoot a little talking head interview. Because it's, you know, he really is kind of the, I don't use the term expert like he's a Bigfoot expert, but when it comes to the Boggy Creek history and story, I really do think he knows more about it now than anyone. And to do that, to just put him in there for 15 minutes or whatever, would have been a disservice to the movie, I thought. So I wanted him in the film, and the idea came to me at some point that, listen, let's have him narrate the film. And if he's going to narrate the film, he cannot be in the film as a talking head interview. He's either going to have to be on camera doing something, or he's not on camera. He's just an off camera narrator. And I knew I wanted him on camera. So the idea came to let him tell the story from a very personal perspective, which is what you get. You know, he's talking about his dad, you know, and him hunting and fishing, you know, towns similar to Falk when he was a kid, and how he grew up with the movie and all that. And then it's balanced by these kind of handheld sequences where he's talking to the actual witnesses. And what I compare it to is, much of the film is you're hearing stories about Bigfoot sightings from people who weren't there. You're hearing about, you know, people telling their aunt's story from the early 1900s, or, you know, a buddy's who saw this creature. And you do get a couple, you know, straightforward witness interviews. But a lot of the talking head interviews are more about the history and the legend of Boggy Creek. And then Lyle shows up on camera with actual witnesses. And it's like, look, that was the legend. This is the reality. Like, this isn't some fun love and adventure for these people.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Like when they see these things, it impacts their lives in a major way, you know, and it might not be a horror movie where they're, you know, being ripped apart or their heads being thrown through the air or something, but it emotionally impacts them for the rest of their lives. You know, Terry Sutton has that line where he says, where he talks about how he's not scared of the creature. What scares him is people. And that was because of the reaction that the town had to him. And so I really feel like those handheld interviews and Lyle showing up on screen is actually helping drive home the reality behind a creature sighting, a sighting of the actual Boggy Creek monster. And I am unbelievably thrilled with the way all of that came together in post, because I'll let you in on a secret. I had no clue if that was going to work. I mean, I was
rolling the dice.
Yeah, I was absolutely trying to come across as totally confident to Brandon, my producer, and to Lyle when we're down at Falk. I'm like, no, trust me, I can. You know, it's all going to be great. And they're like, I don't know. It doesn't seem like maybe I should be on camera if I'm going to be narrating. I'm like, no. So I'm thrilled it came across well in the end. It didn't, you know, bottom out, because it could have been weird. It could have been real weird mm-hmm. to have the guy narrating and then showing up on camera. I kept thinking of Michael Moore movies, though, like early Michael Moore movies. I was like, Lyle definitely is kind of like a Southern Bigfoot version of Michael Moore. That was a joke.
I think it worked out perfect, because anybody that's going to first see the name of the movie, that's going to want to watch it, already knows of Lyle, or should already know. And like you said, you don't want to call anybody the expert, because we don't really even know if they truly exist, because we don't have physical body mm-hmm. of one that we can all go and say, okay, you know, now we know they're out there. This is all 100%. But as far as carrying that torch of the stories, and is kind of like Falk's adopted son, Lyle has spent the time to make those connections, to let the people know that he's not going to exploit them. I'm not going to let you be exploited. We want to tell the story and let the world know what goes on here then and what's still going on here now. And I think you did a great job of bringing that out there. Now, there's something that we discussed off air, and I want to know if you're willing to discuss it here about the sound you heard. If not, we'll leave it alone. But if so, we'll let you tell it, so that way you can tell exactly how much of it you want to. Because I think people, you know, but people should know. It's just a really interesting part of the movie.
So, in the film, and I don't mind giving this away, because I don't feel like we're giving anything away. The whole point of it is what you're actually hearing.
Yeah, exactly. And the reactions of everybody's face there.
right. In the film, we actually, during the filming of the movie, we captured audio of what sounds like something screaming in the distance, like the mournful cry of the creature. And we decided to put it in the movie. So towards the end of the film, you'll actually hear that audio that we recorded. But I guess the craziest thing about it is where we were when we recorded it, which was back in the middle of nowhere, back on Carter Lake, which was also the location where Herb Jones lived. And Herb was the hermit that was in The Legend of Boggy Creek. And he was a real man. He actually existed. He mm-hmm. he lived there. We show what remains of his shack that was seen in the movie. And we show, you know, right around where he lived and all that kind of stuff. But that was where we captured this audio. And it's an unusual scream. We didn't do much with it in post. I'd rather viewers just kind of try to make up their mind for themselves. If you want to, you can boost the audio on your speakers or whatever and try to
pitch.
Yeah. And it is weird, because like when you boost it, you can hear some things in there that aren't readily apparent when you hear it within just within the context of the film. You can hear there's actually what sounds to me like three kind of screams rather than just the two you can kind of make out. I think I catch a third one that's under one of the lines of dialogue. And then there was one other thing about that. I guess I should mention the bloop at the end, right? Is that what you were talking about?
Well, and there's something else that happened in that little time frame, and I don't know who said it off camera, but somebody laughingly makes a joke, it sounds like, and says, oh, is that a tree knock? Like it's a joke. And I hear that, and I'm like, because instantly you have your guard up like, oh, somebody's pulling my leg. Like we really can't be hearing what we're hearing. And then it happens again, that same scream, just a few seconds later, and I'm like... They weren't even prepared for this.
Yeah, so I'll just explain the entire incident. So we're down at Carter Lake, and I'm actually going to go down. At the beginning of that scene, there's a drone shot of Lyle and Doyle walking down the hill. It's right after you're following them down the hill, and then all of a sudden you get this drone shot of them walking down the hill. Well, I had to go down to the bottom of the hill, which is probably 200 yards, 150 yards away from everyone else down around this bend. And it was actually where I went down to was right where we shot their interview about a half hour later. So I went down there, and I was completely alone. And as I'm going down there, I got just a really uneasy feeling, which isn't normal for me when I'm making a movie. I tend to be able to zone out on, you know, fear of death and dismemberment and just kind of focus on getting the work done. But I got a really uneasy feeling down there, and I ended up calling Brandon down to hang out with me while I shot the drone footage and all that stuff. So what happened is when you hear me make the joke about the tree knock, there was what sounded like a crack in the distance.
Okay.
And that was not the only unusual sound we had heard. Zach and I, my cinematographer, the director of photography on this movie, him and I kept hearing what sounded like rocks being thrown into the little creek that ran kind of to the right of where Doyle and Lyle are standing in their shots a little later. We kept hearing, I mean, which is really close to us, and that was why it was bizarre. And we weren't hearing things being thrown into the water anywhere else. It's just like right over there. And so when you're actually seeing that scene, you hear the tree knock thing, it is kind of a joke because I don't know that there was anything. For the most part, we do make a lot of jokes out there because you hear a lot of things, you know. And so it is 100% possible that it was just what we heard could have been a bullfrog or something. But the unusual thing is at the end of that clip, you hear something hit the water. Literally, like the last thing you hear in that clip is like this little blip, and then that clip's over. And that last blip, I didn't notice until I boosted the audio on it in post. And I do know that as we were standing there, we kept hearing something being thrown into the water, like a rock or a stone or something being thrown into the water. And I kept saying something about Zach, and Zach kept saying he was kind of freaked out by that. So there's a lot of weird stuff that was going on down at Carter Lake that night.
Man, that is incredible. Well, it's an amazing movie, as well as your other ones. Tell everybody where they can go and watch these things, because when does it come out? November 12th, you said?
November 11th is kind of the official release date for Boggy Creek Monster. All our movies are on available on DVD. Boggy Creek will actually be available on Blu-ray in like ridiculously limited quantities. I think I only had 100 printed. So there's 100 Boggy Blu-rays, and after that we're probably done with them on Blu-ray. But DVDs and Blu-rays and T-shirts and all that stuff you can buy through our website, which is shop.smalltownmonsters.com. Or if you're a digital streaming person, you can actually buy downloadable copies or streaming copies through our Vimeo on demand. Or we're also available through Amazon. So, and actually, Minerva Monster is free for Amazon Prime subscribers right now. So if you're on Amazon Prime, you can watch Minerva Monster for free, and Beast of Whitehall's on Amazon too. So, and when Boggy comes out, it's already ready to go. Actually, I've got the Boggy file uploaded to Amazon. So on November 11th, first thing, that Foggy Creek Monster will be available on Amazon too. So
awesome.
Yeah, it's yeah. Are you going to be submitting at any film festivals or anything?
So we did that with Beast of Whitehall. Uh-huh. We submitted to a whole bunch of film festivals. We got accepted into, I think, 8 or 9, and actually we just got another request yesterday to have it screened at the Snowtown Film Festival in New York in January. So they actually asked us if they could show it. The experience for Beast of Whitehall was awesome. I mean, it was really cool because that movie has found an audience well beyond what we expected. With Boggy, I'm just not sure because our goals with Boggy are a little different than they were with Beast of Whitehall. With Whitehall, we just wanted it to have an audience, any kind of audience. And with Boggy, I think it's not going to have a problem finding an audience. It might not be an instant Minerva was weird. It went viral. It was, you know, it was everywhere. It was the Animal Planet blog did a thing about it. I mean, it was on TV across the country and newspaper articles and all this stuff. It was very bizarre. But I think Boggy will find an audience, you know, pretty naturally over a few month period is what I'm expecting kind of with that. But I just don't know. It costs a lot of money to submit to film festivals, and we are still a very small, you know, low budget kind of gig. So there might be a couple film festivals we submit to, but I have not yet decided. The other thing is it's a Bigfoot movie, and you have that going against you when you're trying to submit, because for you know, the kind of artsy film festivals, they don't necessarily want to show a Bigfoot movie. And for the horror film festivals, I don't know that I could classify what we're doing as horror.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And
yeah,
we got rejected from some horror film festivals because they responded that it wasn't technically horror. So I'm talking about Whitehall got rejected. Yeah. And I don't know that Boggy goes too much further into like the horror genre. So I just don't know. We're in a weird place because genre wise, we're a documentary. Like just a straight documentary, yeah. But because it's about Bigfoot, which a lot of people consider to be nonsense, they don't necessarily look at it as a documentary. So it is odd to get into film festivals.
Well, and I appreciate the way you did it. I appreciate the way you're open-minded and willing to let anybody, you urge other people to try what you do. And I think that's the reason I urge our listeners to go and rent this or buy this movie, is because it's like shopping at a mom and pop store. You're supporting a small artist versus, you know, big studios. Mm-hmm. It's and you did an amazing job. It's awesome. Before we let you go, what's next for Small Town Monsters? You have any ideas about what you're going to be doing next?
Yeah,
he can't say now. Look, I can't say it. Somebody will jump on it.
Okay, I got it.
I'm not like that. We have a whole list of stuff. So what I really want to do next is Mothman. I'm not 100% sure yet that's going to take place, but that's kind of where I'm looking. And I my dream Bigfoot movie is Momo, and I love Champ, the lake monster. Mm-hmm. So any one of those three would be awesome.
Well, Seth, we truly appreciate all the hard work you've put into all these films, and we'll support you forever and ever, and we urge everybody to go check it out. Thank you so very much for coming on here, sharing your passion, sharing your work with us, and taking the time to chat with us, man. And if you ever need anything, don't hesitate to ask, brother. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, man.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.
And we are back. Okay, well, like we told you, we had a long one there, and it was fun. I mean, I had so much fun, and like we even talked about at the start of the show, before the interview, how much we enjoyed that the work he did, and now you kind of get to hear how he laid it out, how he feels about it, and the whole thing. I love speaking to Seth. I can't wait to see some of the other work that he's going to do. Well, what's funny is we even talked to him for like an hour off air. We just sat around and talked
about technical stuff, right?
Yeah, and just technical stuff. Yeah.
Well, you know what? Like we talk about on the show all the time, if to support small town shops and stuff mm-hmm. in your neighborhood, mom and pop stores, right? Because so much of the corporate world is taking over.
Yes.
No matter where you live, it's fun to support little people. I'm not saying he's little. But he's not like a major studio that's putting out this.
It's not Paramount.
No, this is Seth and just a buddy or two of his, and they're putting out these excellent documentaries. And so it's good to support people like that. I enjoy supporting people like that. I know that he's done Kickstarters before to fund these things. I'm sure he'll be doing that again with his next film. Go and support guys like Seth. These are the guys that are making a difference. These are the guys that are interested in the actual story of what these people are experiencing. Mm-hmm. Not what some crazy producer like on Finding Bigfoot is trying to fabricate for yes. entertainment. That's not what it's doing. Support guys like this. It's excellent.
I think what I like the most about his films is if you have a friend or a family member or a colleague or anybody that you know, you work with this person and all that, that they're constantly kind of coming down on you about, oh, you think there's a big monkey in the woods or whatever the ribbing that we can all take from time to time for people that are closed-minded, and you have this video. Say you own the DVD. Say you say, I'm going to let you borrow this. I want you to watch this movie and just check it out and get back with me. This isn't one of those ones where it's all like you're talking about earlier. It's not all one-sided where there's a previous agenda going into this film.
Yeah.
With what he does, it feels like you could loan it to somebody that's a non-believer and they could still watch it and be like, you know, there is something. Because when you see the interaction with the people, the way he picks up with all of the witnesses and the way in all of his films, I like that part. I like that storytelling aspect of it that lets it come off. It doesn't come off, you can tell, like it's preempted or they're prompt to say anything.
Yeah.
They're just telling their story and kind of reliving it there in their mind on the screen. And I think that's what I appreciate the most. Like I say, I know I've said it about what he does is the natural flow.
Yeah.
The way he releases.
Well, that's the way I kind of think about it. If I was like, when you read a story and you read about the legend of Boggy Creek, excellent book, by the way, by Lyle Blackburn. If I was to go, like, say you're watching at home and you hear about this story and you're like, well, if I had unlimited money and I could go there, what would I want to do?
Mm-hmm.
I'd want to talk to the people. So that's what he's done. You go and you hear the story, you get to go there, and then you actually get to hear the witnesses. To me, that's much better yeah. than people walking around the woods at night with night vision cameras on. Hey, man, did you hear that tree knock?
Howling and tree knocking.
You know, and then how many seasons have they done of that now? Yeah. And you never find nothing. I mean, that's what I like.
Yeah.
I want to go and I want to see the scenery. I want to see what the town's like. And I want to hear from the locals.
Yeah.
But what's crazy is we've talked about this before, about like other towns, even in Texas, that you know some people from. The people that are there, they don't act like it's a big deal. It's like, oh, yeah. For generations, people have been seeing stuff in the woods.
Like it's, yeah, we know it's there.
Excellent. I'm going to put links to it in the show notes. Please go over there and check that out. Before we get out of here, other good shows I'd like to recommend is Gaia.com. Gaia has over 7,000 videos. This is a video streaming service, much like Hulu or mm-hmm. Netflix and stuff. And they got all kinds of stuff, from yoga to transformations, you know, self-help videos over there. My favorite is The Seeking Truth. And they have ancient mysteries, conspiracies, things like that. Lots of stuff about ancient cultures, lots of stuff about UFOs, lots of stuff about the government keeping these things under wraps. We previewed something last week about Michael Tellinger, about the search for the gold and the Anunnaki.
And you know what? I went back and watched it.
Pretty cool, right?
Now I have a problem.
Uh-oh, because you got sucked into the series?
I got sucked into the series. I'm a big Michael Tellinger fan now. Like, I've read some of his work,
yeah.
but never really. And now I've been sucked into it, and now I'm just like, I'm constantly, let me check it all out.
I don't necessarily go along with sometimes the alien agenda.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But there is no doubt that the stuff he's showing is interesting.
Well, I like the way he kind of presents it, too. Just the way his cadence.
Well, he doesn't say that. I'm not saying he suggests
that.
Yeah,
yeah.
But it is always kind of left out there.
Yeah, but I like the way he presents and his cadence and his flow. I appreciate certain things about presenters and storytellers.
It's his voice, right?
Well, it might
be. Is he South African? I don't know.
I don't know. I got to think about this while watching it, and I feel like a moron. How is it that if you want somebody to talk to you about farming or the outdoors or horses or anything like that, you want to hear a Southern drawl. But if you want somebody to talk to you about something educational, you want an English accent. You know what I mean? Right. It almost sells it. So I don't know. That's kind of how I got drawn in. I was like, oh, yeah, let me listen to this guy. Whatever he says is awesome. But I can't help it. I did. I get sucked into that whole series.
I did the same thing. And in addition to those, there's also a whole ton of films and documentaries. Mm-hmm. I watched one recently. It's very cool. It's called The Other World.
No thanks.
And it says it's about this place deep hidden within the south of France that apparently the legend goes that there was a priest there who struck a deal with dark forces. And since that time, there's always strange things going on in this area, like UFOs are being seen. Lots of ghosts are being seen. Doomsday cults are always hanging out there. Doomsday cults are always hanging out there. It's a very interesting area. And you get to see the people there, much like I was talking about what they've seen in this strange area. It's called The Other World. It's pretty cool. There's some other ones on there that are really neat. Like I mentioned before in the show, Mirage Men is on there. Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. And a ton of others that I haven't even gotten to yet. So you need to go over there and check that out. Gaia.com. It's G-A-I-A.com. And of course, they are a sponsor of the show. But look, this is something that I can really get behind. So what do you have planned for the rest of your week?
Well, I am going to, I've got to go to swing to the gun range sometime this week, going up checking out a few handguns.
You're dressed very dapper, by the way. Well, what have you got going on?
I mean, family normally, photo day.
Family photo. I mean, normally you walk in here like you just slept on the street. Right? Today, you actually look awesome.
I don't like it.
You clean up really well. Why don't you dress like that more often?
Dude, because I don't feel right in these clothes. I feel like the little kid that had to fight with his parents before they took him to church.
Or, spitting and combing in their hair.
Yeah, I hate this, man. I do. I don't like being bound in like this whole thing. And I'm wearing jeans, and I'm really not okay with that.
You're usually a short kind of guy.
Year round, man. I'm shorts. And this
hoodies actually, and shorts, yeah, that's your favorite?
I dress like a child. I can't help it, man.
You
act like
a child. You have the mind of a child.
I do have the mind of a child. Yes, I do. All week, that's all. And so other than that, I mean, I don't know. Shooting my bow some and just... I don't know. The weather's cooled off quite a bit, so I'm just going to spend
over
a lot
for
of time.
Me. Yep, I'm done. So now I've got more free time to work on the show.
Yep, so that's probably video. You know what? The video stuff. We'll have that going, but I'm probably going to be shooting some B-roll and just, I really want to look at that drone again. You and I have been checking out that one drone, and I can't help it, so I don't know. I don't know what we're going
to
do.
I don't care if we never even use it. I just like to have one just to be cool.
I just want to have it. I got a drone, and then that's it.
Don't you have to license those things? Or like probably. The FAA and stuff?
You got to license everything these days.
The government is controlling us, folks.
I'm not a fan.
No, leave us alone.
I'm not a fan. Everybody in the U.S., I would say get out and vote, but I'm just going to leave it at that. I don't even know. So
right. Well, I just want to take the time to thank everybody for following us, sharing our stuff on social media and everywhere, especially those elite members. We really enjoyed doing this show, and we could not do it without y'all. So thank you so much. I hope everybody out there has a really good week. And also, I screwed up, Cam.
Well, it wasn't just you, because I'm going to own 50% of this, because I should be paying attention to it also.
We have a P.O. box, folks, for the show. And, you know, that's where people can send us stuff. But no, look, we never bring it up. We're not asking for handouts. We never do. But recently, somebody sent something to the P.O. box, and I hadn't checked it in probably 2 months. So my wife went to the P.O. box, and she checked it for me. I think it was due, like you have to pay for the P.O. box once a year or something. She was like, hey, you know that the money for that is due. So she went down there, paid it, and checked it. It was like, holy crap, there's a package in here. She brought home the package. There's this long tube. And I see it was sent from somewhere in New England. I'm like, what is this? Did Cam order something? I don't know. I opened it up, and it's amazing artwork. Artwork that we never even asked for. And this person is an amazing artist. He sent us a couple different things. Cam, what do you...
It's Mr. Christian Perez of the New Hope Tattoo Gallery.
Yeah, man, it is awesome. There's like a mantis being here. There's like some kind of steampunk-looking crow. And then there's some of these skulls. It's not like a sugar skull, but...
I'm lying. It's Hope Gallery Tattoo.
Okay.
Well. Yeah, Christian Perez at New Haven. This is unbelievable. Brother, thank you very much. If any of y'all ever send us anything and you don't hear us talk about it in like 2 weeks, please message the show or email the show or something, because literally we've beat this horse to death. We're idiots, folks. We've got so much going on. We're like, it's horrible. It's horrible. Like I said, me and Kyle, one of us usually goes by and checks the P.O. box randomly, but sporadically, but we do it. We haven't done it in forever because we've been busy with all of this and not paying any attention.
Most of the time it's just bills.
Yeah.
So I'm not in any hurry to go pick those
up. Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And then now there was this. So I feel terrible. But Christian, thank you so very much. This is amazing.
Yeah. Thank you to everyone out there who listens and supports Expanded Perspectives. And we'll be talking to you elite members on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll speak to you again on Monday. Be safe out there. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hill.
Peace, y'all.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.